This podcast was recorded Thursday, October 12th at 11:25 a.m. Things may have changed by the time you hear this. Like Republicans in Washington, we'll have a drama-free vote for Speaker of the U.S. House. That's unlikely with Jim Jordan in the mix. Let's talk politics. This is Snollygoster, WOSU Public Media's weekly look at Ohio politics and all those Snollygosters, those shrewd politicians who look for your vote. I'm Mike Thompson. Election month is here. Because of early voting, we really cannot just point to Election Day. Maybe we should call it Election Results Day. Voting has begun in one of the most interesting and potentially most important elections in Ohio in recent memory. Voters are deciding one of the most controversial issues of our time, whether Ohio should enshrine abortion rights in the state's constitution. In these final 4 weeks, the campaign for and against Issue 1 certainly will intensify. The yes on one side has been running TV ads for weeks urging voters to support the abortion rights amendment. This week, the no on one side unveiled its first major TV ad buy. It features Governor Mike DeWine and his wife Fran looking right at voters and urging them to vote no. One of the arguments the governor, his wife, and other abortion rights opponents make is that parents will lose the right to have a say if their daughter chooses to have an abortion. We want to get into that a little bit this week. We want to get to the facts, get beyond the rhetoric. So this week, I talked to a constitutional law expert and an OBGYN to try to learn if that is the case. Will parents lose the right to oversee their minor children's care? First up is Dan Coble. He's a law professor at Capital University. Let's talk about the legal terms here. Issue 1, the proposed amendment, guarantees that individuals have the right to make their own reproductive decisions, including abortion. Legally, what is the word individual? What does that mean?
Well, it means, to be honest, whatever the Ohio Supreme Court interprets it to mean. For example, the Ohio Constitution guarantees people the right to bear arms, and yet we do not interpret the right to bear arms as being the same for children and adults. So individual refers to all people, and it may still apply differently when you're talking about children and adults, as it does with most constitutional rights.
Now, Ohio does have a parental consent law on the books now. It requires a parent or guardian to give a parent, not both parents, but a parent to give consent, written consent for to have an abortion, unless the individual feels that's not good for them. Maybe perhaps a case of abuse or something like that, they can go to a judge. Would Issue 1, if it passes, what would it do to that parental consent law?
Yeah, that is the main line of attack, at least, that we're seeing in a lot of the ads. And I think that Issue 1 would not automatically invalidate that law at all. I think this is something that would basically hinge, if the state wants to defend that law, one, if it's challenged, and then a court would have to rule, and ultimately that would probably be up to the Ohio Supreme Court to decide. It would really depend on whether the state can demonstrate that the parental consent law is the least restrictive means to advance the individual's health in accordance with widely accepted evidence-based standards of care. Now, I think there's probably a pretty good likelihood that the state could succeed in defending it on those grounds, the grounds that parental consent in most cases advances a minor's interest in protecting their health. That was in part what the U.S. Supreme Court said when they upheld Ohio's law back in 1990. And they did that under the Roe versus Wade standard, which was the most demanding standard that the state had to face. So the state was able to successfully defend its law. I think the court said something to the effect that parents will know the minor's medical records, will be able to help protect their health in that way. That was one of the points that they made.
Yeah, I guess that's the question I had is, you know, Dobbs overturned Roe, but Dobbs did not overturn Casey and other rulings regarding abortion, correct?
No, Dobbs did overturn it Casey did. Okay. As well. Yeah, yeah. Dobbs basically said the Roe-Casey line is not protected under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. So basically they said all fundamental rights, remember Casey affirmed Roe's holding that there was a fundamental right for a person to terminate a pre-viability pregnancy. And in Dobbs, they said that's not true.
Okay, so but how does Dobbs affect, does not affect the parental consent rulings then?
No, I think it at least gives, well, the parental consent rulings, to be honest, are largely irrelevant now that Dobbs has overturned
yes,
Roe
true.
And Casey.
Yeah.
So they really are only helpful as analogs to predict how a state court might come out. Mm-hmm. I think that we might look at that and say, oh, the U.S. Supreme Court, which was probably in 1990 a more liberal court than we have in Ohio today, upheld parental consent. That at least suggests to me and many legal scholars that it would be likely that the Ohio Supreme Court could well find that the parental consent law is constitutional. Now, that would depend a lot on the record that a trial court was presented with on how the Ohio parental consent law is being applied. I've seen reporting in the Washington Post that's talked about how in many states, parental consent laws with a judicial bypass, that's what you described, yeah. The judicial bypass. The judicial bypass has been used arbitrarily by many judges. Many judges rely on very idiosyncratic things, like they'll say, well, your GPA is not high enough to make a decision about this. Mm-hmm. And so if there were a record that said, for example, that Ohio courts were not allowing minors to effectively use the judicial bypass, then perhaps it would be open to challenge. But I still think that would be a long shot mm-hmm. for abortion rights proponents to try to knock out the parental consent statute.
You know, Michigan last November put in their constitution, voters put in their constitution guaranteeing abortion rights, and they do have a law, a consent abortion parental consent law with regards to abortion, and that law is still on the books, and I don't believe it's been challenged yet. And it's been, you know, close to a year since the Michigan Constitutional Amendment went into effect.
Yeah, I believe that is true, Mike. In fact, when I looked at the Michigan law, because I'd been asked several times about Ohio and what the experience was in Michigan, it appears that even though Michigan is completely in the control of a Democratic legislature and a Democratic governor, the Democrats in revising Michigan's abortion laws have specifically declined to revise the parental consent law. So at least the reporting I've seen in the Detroit News from September said that the current Reproductive Health Act that they are proposing does not invalidate that. So one, that makes two things clear. One, that the legislature believes they have to change the law and that the amendment itself didn't automatically knock it out. And two, even with the Democratic legislature, they do not believe that it is something that should be done. Now, I think that it's certainly possible yeah. that you know, Planned Parenthood or other groups could challenge it, but it doesn't look like this is something that the legislature wants to do.
Yeah, once it's in the Constitution, it could be challenged at any time. And they may, the advocates for abortion rights may be saying, we're not going to challenge it now while all these other states are going through this, because this would give ammunition to those folks who are arguing that parental rights would disappear if this was in the Constitution.
Absolutely. I mean, the other thing that you know, attorneys for those groups would be looking at is strategically, is this the court that you want to decide this? So if you have a very conservative court, you might well not want that court ruling on this particular issue if you really hope to succeed in knocking out parental consent.
How do you look at the gender-affirming care argument that opponents to issue one are making, that this amendment, if enshrined in the Constitution, because it deals with reproductive care, that it would eliminate parental consent from a minor seeking gender-affirming care?
Well, I think that's an even greater stretch than the argument that it will knock out parental consent for abortions. For one thing, the amendment itself, in the specifically listed reproductive freedom decisions, does not list gender-affirming care. It lists things that are quite specifically related to reproduction. So gender-affirming care might be seen as at least indirectly related to reproduction, but I think it's much less likely that a court would suddenly say, hey, this amendment was intended to also enshrine a right for a minor to have gender-affirming care, and the normal laws that apply requiring parental consent for medical treatment don't apply either. So I think that's even a step farther away from the argument on parental consent with regard to abortion.
It's one of the things that I find most interesting here. It came up with this fight over the Ohio Department of Education. There's an amendment in the Constitution that says that there shall be a Board of Education and there shall be a state superintendent of schools, but it's less clear what powers they have. And the argument is that the courts will look at what was the intent of the voter when they approved this amendment. So in that case, they intended to root out corruption in the education department. So what does that mean now? They'll decide that. In this case, so how do courts decide? How do they look at how can courts tell what the intent of the voter was when this amendment was passed?
Yes, that's a great question, Mike, because they obviously can't look into the minds of individual voters, let alone collectively.
This education one was like 50 years ago.
Exactly.
So what's going to happen 50 years from now when they start looking at this amendment?
Well, you know, one of the things that courts look at, and in fact, we do it looking back to 1791. The Supreme Court does it with regard to what did the framers think over 200 years ago with regard to U.S. constitutional amendments. But what they would probably do is look at things like the arguments that were made by proponents of the amendment, whether they sold this as being about gender-affirming care. So if they ran ads or if they had descriptions of what the amendment would do, and they said one of the things it is going to protect is gender-affirming care, then a court might be more likely to say, yeah, voters knew that's what they were doing. Ironically, opponents of the amendment who are saying this will allow gender-affirming care, if the bill passes, their statements might be actually used by someone arguing that it does protect that to show that's what voters knew they were voting on. However, I haven't seen any indication that proponents are really saying this is about gender-affirming care.
Yeah, you could buy campaigning hard on the no side that this would affect gender-affirming care, and the voters say yes to issue one. You could easily argue that voters rejected that argument.
Right.
But, you know, the proponents of issue one aren't really campaigning much on parental rights. They're campaigning on privacy, the ability for families and their doctors to make these decisions by themselves. They're campaigning on we shouldn't have government intervention in private health care decisions. They're basically trying to avoid this parental rights issue. They're saying it won't affect parental rights, but it's not a major focus of that campaign. Could that hurt them down the road if it is challenged?
Meaning if they attempt to invalidate parental rights,
yeah,
could that hurt them? Certainly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it could essentially, if there are representatives of the campaign who say we do not see this as automatically invalidating parental rights, or we think it's unlikely. In fact, in Michigan, the Michigan Attorney General said she did not believe that it affected the parental consent laws, and that's one of the things that I've seen reported, not by the courts, but reported in media outlets about why, in fact, they would need to pass a law if they wanted to change that.
Ohio's parental consent law does not extend to contraception, does it? It's basically medical procedures.
I believe that's correct, yeah. Yes. Although I think there is an exception for venereal disease and things like that.
Okay. Maybe for IUD or something like that, something that requires a procedure more than just taking a pill or using some other method.
Yeah, I think that's true, although I will give you the caveat that I'm a constitutional law professor, not a medical lawyer.
Yes. One other thing real quickly is there's a difference between parental consent and parental notification. Some states have parental notification where you just have to tell a parent that you're going to have an abortion.
That's true. That's true. And to be honest with you, the Supreme Court in the Akron case said that it really didn't differentiate between the two because they largely have similar effects. So they basically said parental consent and parental notification were both permissible.
How do you watch this as a law professor? How do you watch this campaign and I'm sure you studied what the proponents of Issue 1 put in their amendment, what they did not put in their amendment. They could have put, I think the Florida proposed amendment has in there people over the age of 18. It does have an age limit. This does not. So that you can see that the legal arguments for not including it, also for including it.
Yeah, I think that actually the amendment was quite well crafted, given what a difficult task they had, because they didn't simply want to guarantee a right to abortion. They had to also address the plethora of laws that have popped up and been enacted in order to try to discourage or prevent abortion. So in the wake of Casey, where the Supreme Court loosened up the kinds of laws states could pass, they did things like saying, we're going to advance women's health by imposing extremely expensive sorts of requirements for abortion clinics, even though it's not a particularly unsafe procedure.
So you can see challenges on this, the requirements that you have a transfer agreement from a clinic to a hospital, or the 24-hour waiting period. You can see those challenges coming before parental consent.
It's more likely, I think, particularly because those are very directly burdensome and they may not be related to protecting the health of the individual very well. So the state might have a harder time defending those.
That was Dan Coble, Capital University law professor, laying out how the Abortion Rights Amendment and abortion regulations might be interpreted if Issue 1 passes in November. We'll be right back.
This is my voice. It can tell you a lot about me, and I'm not changing it for anyone. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of NPR episodes centered on the Black experience. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get podcasts.
Okay, so we're done with the legal side of the issue. Now we turn to the medical side. We spoke to a Central Ohio OBGYN and family planning specialist, Dr. Courtney Carestis. She is also a fellow with Physicians for Reproductive Health. It's a group that does not take positions on state issues. Dr. Carestis, we cited the 2022 Ohio abortion report. It shows that 8% of those having abortions in Ohio were under the age of 20, roughly 1,500 people. Unfortunately, we don't know how many were under the age of 18. Do you have any estimate about how many minors terminate their pregnancy in Ohio?
The most recent data that I've seen in Ohio is about 2% of abortions are for those under the age of 18. So really a small proportion there that 18 to 19 age group makes up for a much larger proportion of that statistic you described.
So it is a small number, but it's not an unimportant number. These are young people who are facing a very difficult situation.
Yep, it certainly is not an unimportant number. These are patients who desperately need care, who've considered their decisions and often discussed that with their families or other loved ones and made the decision to end their pregnancy. They deserve that right to make that decision.
Do you know of those folks, that 2% who get abortions then in that age group, do you have any estimate of how many go through the judicial review who do not get their parental consent?
I don't have an exact number for that, but just from my clinical experience, I would say it's a pretty small percentage, maybe 10% of those minors who are seeking abortion care that go through the judicial process versus coming in with their parents or guardian.
Mm-hmm. Of course, we don't want to betray any privacy here, but how arduous is that judicial process for someone who cannot or chooses not to try to get parental consent?
It can be a very burdensome process. I mean, this we're talking about here, teens who, for whatever reason, often they don't have a close relationship with their parents or feel like their parents will punish them or there will be adverse consequences to their home life if they tell their parents about needing an abortion. So they're already going through that turmoil, and then they have to come to a clinic and establish care, know how far along they are in the pregnancy, and then go to a court, find a court-appointed lawyer, fill out the required paperwork, and sit in front of a judge and have that judge ask them many personal questions. So it's a hard process and an already hard time for these patients, and definitely adds length and delays their care that they would otherwise be able to receive more quickly.
How long does that take?
Generally, it's done within about 5 days of reaching out to the court, I believe is the by business days is the legal limitation on that. But even getting to that point of being able to find a judge and a lawyer and all of that can take additional time.
I know the so-called cardiac activity law is on hold right now, but 5 days could be a long time if the heartbeat can be detected in that week, correct?
It certainly is. 5 days could make a huge difference. While the cardiac activity ban was in effect in Ohio, we would have to still comply with the rest of Ohio's laws. So patients would come for their first visit where they'd have an ultrasound and determine if cardiac activity was present, then sign their consent forms. And then because of the state requirements, wait 24 hours before coming back for their next visit where they could actually have the abortion done. And even in that 24-hour wait between signing the consent forms and coming back for the next visit, we had many, many patients we had to turn away because at the second visit, there now was cardiac activity present. So if 24 hours can make that much of a difference, certainly 5 days can as well.
We're talking with Dr.
Another really...
Oh, go ahead, please. I'm sorry to interrupt.
I was just going to add that another really hard thing for adolescent pregnancies in general is that younger people tend to not find out they're pregnant as early on in the pregnancy. They're, you know, less likely to be tracking cycles and knowing exactly when they had a missed period. And with a six ban in place, you basically have to already know on the day you missed your period that you need to start seeking abortion care if you have to also go through a judicial bypass before 6 weeks rolls around.
What about medication abortions? How does parental consent work with young people seeking those types of abortions?
All of the same laws apply for medication abortion or a procedural abortion. So parental consent or a judicial bypass is still required in that case.
Mm-hmm. How does the parental consent law affect patients across the socioeconomic and racial spectrum? Does it affect all patients equally, or do you see differences there?
In general, any restriction on abortion care tends to affect those who are coming from the most disadvantaged situations the most. So those at lower socioeconomic status and Black, Indigenous, and people of color are much more likely to be affected by these laws because of all the other systemic factors stacked against them. We know that in Ohio, Black patients have a disproportionate number of abortions and therefore also are more likely to be, impacted by the parental consent laws.
Mm-hmm. I think I think the thinking is by placing restrictions on before the Dobbs decision, when Roe allowed for abortions up to the point of fetal viability, that many states, including Ohio, passed laws, the transfer agreement law, that clinics had to have a transfer agreement with a hospital, the 24-hour waiting period, the requirement that physicians make ultrasounds available to their patients, and also the parental consent laws, was meant to discourage folks from having an abortion. The more steps in the process might cause the person to reconsider. In your experience, does the parental consent law discourage abortions? Do parents convince their children to keep the baby or perhaps give the baby up for abortion? What is your experience there?
My experience in this area is somewhat limited because I end up seeing the patients who do make it into the clinic mm-hmm. who are there with their parents or who have gone through the judicial bypass process. So I can't say, how many of the other people out there with a pregnancy as a minor have told their parents and then had some kind of the parent step in and change their mind about that decision. In general, for our patients seeking abortion, they have made up their minds and are quite sure about their decision, despite all of these hoops that the state of Ohio makes us go through and all the requirements for consents and the ultrasound and all of those steps. You know, people are determined to get this care that they need, and they are going to get it.
Do you support some kind of a parental consent law? Do you think that they are wise? I mean, we have parental consent for other surgical procedures, but there's a debate over this one. Is it a good thing to require parents give consent or at least be notified of their child's situation?
Yeah, so I actually have experience previously working in a state where parental consent was not required for anyone over the age of 14. And even in that situation, I found that most adolescents who had a good relationship with their parents would actually still involve them in their choice to have an abortion and in their other reproductive health care decisions. I think the parental consent law sets up a barrier for those most disadvantaged groups that Ari was discussing, mm-hmm. And the judicial bypass can make it so much harder. So I don't necessarily think that a parental consent law is necessary to ensure the safety. People over the age of 14 often are able to very much understand the implications of a pregnancy on their health and well-being and their future and make that decision themselves. So while I think it's great that parents can be involved and certainly would want them to be involved if there's that good relationship there, I don't think it should be required. And interestingly, I also practice as an OBGYN. In general, parents do have to consent for pregnancy care for their minor children. But then once that minor child has a child of their own, they are considered in the eyes of the state completely capable of providing all medical consent for that child once they become a parent. So I think they should also be able to make the decisions for their own health in that situation.
We had this question earlier. Does Ohio law require parental consent for any other reproductive care? Contraception, various forms of contraception, does it require parental consent?
So the law is somewhat vague here, and I'm not a lawyer, but yeah. I know what happens in our clinical practice is that parental consent is not necessarily required for things like birth control that don't involve a procedure, as long as the minor is capable of expressing understanding for what the birth control would do. And kind of can talk through the risks and benefits and seem to make an educated decision about that, then they're able to make that decision on their own. However, there does sometimes become an issue if the patient is on their parents' insurance, because if a visit or medications are run through that insurance, the parents might be notified inadvertently through that anyway.
Yeah, I've heard of those cases happening where a student, not even a minor student, but a student in college, the insurance bill comes in and has care that the parent was not aware was happening. You said it's rare. Most of your patients do have are in the fortunate situation of having their parental support. But in the cases where they don't, what's going on there? Is it always abuse, or is it just reluctance to notify the parents?
You know, every situation is going to be different. It might not be abuse per se by their parents, but it also could be that their parents have threatened to not let them live in their house anymore if they got pregnant, or, you know, other family situations and other dynamics like that. And, you know, it can also be fear. If teens perceive that getting pregnant is a wrong thing, they might just be reluctant to tell anyone about that and want that privacy for themselves.
That is Dr. Courtney Carestis, a Central Ohio OBGYN and family planning specialist. We hope this episode helps set things straight in the debate over parental rights in the Issue One campaign. Now, usually we do our Snollygoster of the Week segment at this point in the show, honoring a shrewd politician or political move. You know, but with the terrible attack on Israel and Israel's response to Hamas and the Gaza Strip, we're going to give it a rest this week. We hope that justice and peace prevail in the Middle East. That will do it for this week's edition of Snollygoster, which is part of the NPR network. As always, please be sure to leave us a good review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, and just tell your friends about us. For our student producer, Katie Genius, our digital producer, Michael DeBonis, I'm Mike Thompson. For Snollygoster from WOSU Public Media.